You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. Ahead in the next hour, football fighters and the AFPAC future. Samira Shackle and James Schneider, my studio guests, will plough through the day's top stories. Then we hear from a man who may have been one of the greatest influences on the artist Damien Hirst, his college lecturer, Glyn Thompson. And later in the show...
If you speak a word of what I'm about to show you, you will be executed for high treason.
It's beautiful.
It's the greatest encryption device in history, and the Germans use it for all communications.
We head to LA to hear about The Imitation Game and other new releases with Our Lady of Cinema, Karen Krasanovich. All that, plus we check in with our man in Milan as well, hearing a little bit of nuns singing. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Before we get started on all that, though, here's Bill Bingham with the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News. A new United Nations report says Islamic State is committing war crimes and imposing a rule of terror in areas it controls in Syria. The report, compiled after hundreds of witnesses were interviewed, says IS has used extreme violence against civilians. According to the report, some men caught smoking have had their fingers amputated, while a female dentist who treated men was publicly beheaded. The group has seized large parts of Syria and Iraq since June. The report by UN human rights investigators entitled Rule of Terror: Living Under ISIS in Syria is the first in which the UN closely examines tactics by IS, which is also known as ISIS or ISIL. The chairman of the Commission of Inquiry on Syria, Paolo Pinheiro, says IS leaders must be held accountable by an international court.
Among the paper's recommendations is a call to hold individuals, including ISIS commanders, responsible for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Executions, amputations, and lashings in public spaces have become a regular occurrence. The display of mutilated bodies has only further terrorized and traumatized Syrians, in particular children.
Iraqi officials say their forces have driven out Islamic State fighters from the oil refinery town of Baiji, 200 kilometres north of Baghdad. Iraqi state television are reporting the town has been completely liberated. There are reports of heavy fighting still going on around the refinery, which is Iraq's largest. IS seized Baiji in June during a lightning advance through northern Iraq and laid siege to the refinery. The Australian city of Brisbane has deployed thousands of police officers as world leaders gather there for the G20 summit. In what's believed to be the largest peacetime security operation in Australia's modern history, more than 6,000 police officers and 900 soldiers will be guarding the leaders' safety during the two-day summit starting on Saturday. One of the leaders present, Russian President Vladimir Putin, has condemned US and EU sanctions introduced over Russia's annexation of Crimea and its alleged involvement in the rest of eastern Ukraine. He says the sanctions will harm not only Russia, but the global economy. The World Health Organization has begun assessing more than 120 potential treatments for Ebola patients, but so far has found none that definitely work. Despite the apparent success of ZMapp, which was given to two American aid workers who recovered, the WHO says there's no proof it played a role. The WHO's Dr. Martin Frieder says the chances of finding a viable drug in the near future are slim.
What is certain is that we don't have actually a lot of drugs in our pipeline which look promising. So we have established a working group that will be reviewing drugs on an ongoing basis and trying to find some supportive data.
Sweden says it has clear evidence a small submarine illegally entered its waters last month, although it's not sure where it was from. Prime Minister Stefan Löfven has condemned the incursion into the Stockholm archipelago and has warned his country will defend its borders with all available means. Sweden launched its biggest anti-submarine operation since the Cold War, following reports of an underwater craft in the archipelago on 17th of October. Elections are taking place in Burkina Faso next year after leaders agreed on the form of a new transitional authority. Street demonstrations saw the president, Blaise Compaoré, resign, ending his 27-year rule. The military assumed temporary charge and have now agreed on future policy with political, civil and religious leaders. The Philae lander has begun drilling into the surface of Comet 67P, amid fears its main battery may die within hours. Researchers at the European Space Agency say the instrument is being deployed to its maximum extent, despite the risk of toppling the lander. Scientists hope they'll be able to capture some samples for analysis in the robot's onboard laboratories. If the battery dies, the results may not make it back to Earth. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, de London. This is Monocle 24.
Orlando, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 18:06 here in London, 14:06. If you've just had your lunch in New York, let's talk about today's news. Joining me now with their take on what's happened in the last 24 hours across the world, here in the studio are Monocle contributors James Schneider, editorial director at New African Magazine, and London-based journalist Samira Shackle. Welcome both to the programme. Good to see you. Let us begin in Pakistan and Afghanistan, two countries arguably finding themselves with a finger on the reset button when it comes to both their own future and their futures with each other, because we've had the departure of Hamid Karzai from the president's office in Afghanistan and British combat troops from Camp Bastion. So the situation is, in theory, ripe for Afghanistan to seize its day. And this, of course, offers some potential for relations to improve with the neighbours. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani is to meet Pakistani leaders on a trip. Samira Shackle, what are the expectations of this visit?
Well, I think that in an ideal world, it would be a sort of complete reset of relations and a new chapter, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know how realistic that is, but I think it's a positive thing that that dialogue's opening up, because you've had sort of years and years, decades, in fact, of recrimination and tension between the two. Hamid Karzai was very openly critical of the Islamabad government, sort of accused them of allowing militant safe havens and so on in the tribal areas. At the same time, you have the Pakistani government accusing Kabul of encouraging militants in Balochistan and allowing cross-border attacks to happen. So it's a sort of web of recriminations, which is a shame, really, when you have two incredibly interlinked countries where the security threat is so interlinked. I mean, that border between Afghanistan and Pakistan is one of the most porous in the world.
It's effectively the same threat, isn't it?
Well, pretty much. I mean, it's separate groups, but it's so sort of porous that they can, you know, you attack in Afghanistan, they move over the border to havens in Pakistan, vice versa. So, and you sort of have with the current military offensive in Waziristan, you've seen that in evidence. The Pakistani military has gone in to attack the Pakistani Taliban, but sort of gave a heads up to militants who are operating in Afghanistan to give them time to, allegedly gave them a heads up to give them time to cross over the border into Afghanistan. So it's a shame, really, that it's been so marked by mutual suspicion, as opposed to any sort of working together, which is actually needed to tackle the threat in any meaningful way.
James, just looking at what's happened in the last couple of months, I mean, within the last month or so, last 3 weeks, British combat troops drew down from Camp Bastion. They went back to the United Kingdom. Does that, do you think, give those on the ground in Afghanistan the opportunity to perhaps determine their own future, indeed determine their own security, or is it still a total mess?
Well, I think it can probably and probably will be both of those things. I mean, of course, not having foreign troops forces you to take control of your own security. But whether they're going to be able to do that is questionable. I mean, as Samira was saying, the kind of long-standing degree of meddling within security, both sides of the border, but especially with the Pakistani security forces and their relationship with extremists in Afghanistan, the relationship between the Pakistani government in the 90s and the rise of the Taliban is reasonably well documented. So, I mean, Britain not being there gives an ability for a reset, but it's a reset which is almost, I mean, it seems very, very difficult to see how it would come about.
A reset you think is going to be difficult to come about? What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think that, I think, as I said earlier, I think it's really good that a dialogue is happening, and that shows that shows a sort of willingness on both sides in terms of government to reset those relations. And you had the Pakistani foreign minister saying, talking about it as sort of the same security threat and the importance of working together. But I think the fact also remains that those sorts of political, geopolitical concerns that have underpinned that meddling over all those years haven't gone away, and you've got intense anxiety in Pakistan about what will happen when NATO goes, and primarily the fear that India will step in to fill the gap, and their absolute paranoia about the idea of India sort of having a ally right on the border. So I think that fear won't go away, and therefore the sort of reasons for that meddling won't go away. And so even if you have this intention in government, it's the fact that the state doesn't really talk with one voice.
The fact, though, is that we have the departure of Hamid Karzai. I think most people were not sad that that particular era ended. And then we've just had the arrival, after an enormous fashion, of President Ashraf Ghani. To what degree is Hamid Karzai's departure and Ashraf Ghani's arrival a double bonus, insofar as do we have someone who could do something here?
I think that's the hope. I mean, he's an expert on failed states for a start. He's written a book about it when he was at the World Bank. He's sort of, so that's his thing. I mean, it's definitely hopeful that he will sort of work to make not only to work on domestic problems like the gross huge scale of corruption that you saw under Karzai's government, but he'll also work on resetting international relations a bit. But I do think that in terms of a relationship like that between Afghanistan and Pakistan, it's not just about the quality of leadership on one side. You also do have to consider the fact that there might be willingness in the Pakistani side in government to make that relationship better, but the government doesn't necessarily have control over the security services and the military.
So without that control of the security services and the military, how, James, do you think that these two nations might be able to address this big problem, which is the Taliban, which there has been so many approaches as to whether the Taliban should be talked to, shouldn't be talked to, strategies in Waziristan that the Pakistanis say are driving them back. You get the impression that there is still a very piecemeal approach. If you have these two nations hopefully talking together, what hope is there?
Well, it's more hopeful than if they're not working together. But I think we should be cautious and remember that there's no unity within either country, and that a lot of the ways in which the more extremist militant groups have been able to develop, receive safe haven for a period in one area, then be told to move to another one, has been to do with internal rivalries within both countries and within the security services. And that's significantly harder to deal with, because those are the sort of internal dynamics that big diplomacy, big public statements can't really unpick.
Let's turn now to plans by the British government to fast-track new anti-terror legislation. This month, a bill will be tabled in the Parliament to stop UK nationals from coming back into the UK if they've been abroad fighting jihad or have been suspected of fighting jihad. They'll face either a 2-year ban, prosecution, or will have to agree to close security surveillance. Sounds simple enough, doesn't it, James?
Well, I mean, so the thing I don't quite understand about this is it will make people who are suspected of doing something, not having been convicted of doing anything, it will make them stateless if they don't have another citizenship, which seems quite a difficult and legally awkward thing to do, especially given the UN now has a particular focus on stateless peoples. I think a kind of calmer way of dealing with it would be to bring people back, and if there are evidence of their, you can monitor them, they're going to be monitored anyway. And if there's evidence of crimes committed, and as we'll be discussing, their heinous crimes are being committed by ISIS and by ISIS fighters, then they should be prosecuted. But I think this is really grandstanding. This is we're dealing with a big problem and everybody should be calm and also like us for it, rather than trying to tackle something which is potentially a real security threat.
One wonders, however, Samira, that yes, okay, the idea of citizenship and the ability to come back being an unconditional legal right of citizenship. But if you are going off to join the likes of Islamic State, a group which has indeed created its own caliphate, or says it has, will those out there really care if they can never come home?
I think there's several points to pick up on there. The first is that lots of those people don't want to come home at all, and they've made that quite explicit, and you can see that in the fact that they're so sort of open on social media, for instance, about their activities and so on. Lots of the young men who go there do so with, and women of course, do so with no intention at all of coming back. The second point of that is that people go for all sorts of reasons. Lots of people become disillusioned with war and want to come back, and it's really important to give those people a route out, because it by sort of banning those people from coming back, if they haven't committed a serious crime and they've been on the fringes and they want to reintegrate, then you create a self-fulfilling prophecy of those people becoming international terrorists, essentially, because you don't really give them the option. I think these plans are slightly different to ones that were touted earlier, because they do give the option of surrendering yourself at the border and agreeing to close monitoring. But I'd be inclined to agree with James that I'm not really sure what it achieves. I think it's quite grandstanding. I don't know what it achieves to ban people for coming back for 2 years. And it's because of that legal awkwardness that they can't, that they're not actually stripping citizenship altogether, that it's a sort of temporary ban. But since we have already the most broad-reaching counter-terror laws in Europe, and if people have if you can prove that someone's committed a crime abroad, then you can try them in a court of law. I don't really see what you gain by just banning people from coming back into the country.
I just want to pick up on Samira's second point, which I think is really important, about people who are at the fringes, or people who went over and being able to come back. I mean, at the moment, ISIS or Islamic State, whatever we want to call them, they have for some people very good propaganda. And people, there are people who are going over to that part of Iraq and Syria on essentially false pretenses and unsure what they're going to get, thinking that things are significantly different there than they are. And I think it would be very foolish to stop those people coming back and saying, actually, there aren't swimming pools for all of the children, mm-hmm. and things are pretty horrible, and you don't want to watch somebody being crucified.
It's one of those things that when you think not only of the international legal difficulties that you face by putting these bans or these blocks on people, do you not have to think as well, Samira, about what happens to people in the United Kingdom? What sending a signal like this means to the Muslim population in the UK? I think a couple of months ago, the London Mayor Boris Johnson said that there are thousands of people being monitored by the services in London as we speak. And religious leaders were coming out saying, actually, you may as well just replace the word people with Muslims, because effectively that is what's being pushed forward as a public image.
Yeah, well, I think that's something that's been the case for certainly since the 9/11 attack, so for the last 13 years at least, that you've got very sort of widespread surveillance of Muslim communities and so on. And I do think that's bad, and it's counterproductive when it's so indiscriminate, I think. So with something like this issue, yes, you should be focusing on prevention, but you also don't want to, it's a careful line to tread, because you don't want to create suspect communities who are then further alienated. And actually, I'm sort of talking to experts who are talking to foreign fighters and so on, a lot of it's not really about religion at all. It's about alienation, it's about feeling lost, it's about feeling shut out. And I think that is really counterproductive, particularly when you have like Boris Johnson talking about taking away the principle of innocent until proven guilty. I mean, that's insane to talk about that for one. That's the foundation of our entire justice system for hundreds and hundreds of years. So to talk about stripping that essentially for one demographic of the population feeds into every victim narrative and piece of propaganda that ISIS brings. And just another point on Cameron's suggestions today, or well, policy announcement today, was that he's talking about extending the right to temporarily strip passports from extending that ability to police and border officials, which I think is also there's no sense of what will be done to safeguard against wrongdoing in that case, because if you look, for instance, at the ongoing controversy and statistics about stop and search and racial profiling on that basis, what basis do you have to believe that suddenly the police will acquire the ability to very, very fairly impose these new powers?
It all becomes rather subjective, doesn't it? Mm. I mean, where are the checks and balances to be found here, James? Obviously, the government is, the United Kingdom government is trying to find a way to stop the flow of young men and women heading out to Syria and Iraq, regardless of what the political motives may be. They have a problem that they need to address.
Yes, and I don't think passing a particular law or changing a particular piece of regulation over people's ability to travel or not is going to do that. The problem lies far more deeply. And if somebody wanted to leave the UK without a passport, they would be able to leave the UK without a passport in the same way that if people really want to get into the UK without a passport, they can. And I think this is a way, as I was saying before, I think this is a way to look like you're doing something about a problem which is a serious problem without really doing anything, and it's causing real terrible legal muddles. And this is now becoming a hallmark of the government, where we've seen all the former legal officers, Ken Clark and Dominic Grieve and Garnier, all saying that this doesn't make any legal sense.
And all being booted out
And all being booted out from office.
Yeah. The time is approaching 21 minutes past the hour. Let's have a short break. You're listening to Midori House, here with me, Emma Nelson. James Schneider and Samira Shackle will be back when we return.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson, joined by James Schneider and Samira Shackle to go through the day's top stories. A moment ago, we were talking about the legal muddle that the British government is finding itself in terms of what it can and cannot do with those they suspect heading out to the likes of Syria and Iraq. They're joining the so-called Islamic State. And as we heard in the news, a United Nations inquiry has concluded that the group which controls large swathes of Iraq and Syria is committing numerous war crimes. There are calls for those responsible to face justice at the ICC. All that needs to be done, of course, is to catch them. James, the Islamic State is like water, isn't it? That you can't catch them as they try and come in and out of borders. You can't catch them in terms of bringing them to justice. And this is another example of someone saying this is very, very bad, but there's very little that we can do about it legally or practically.
Well, there's not that much that can be done about it right away. But if you look at other cases where there have been calls for international tribunals over war crimes, they take a very long time in order to, one, build up the case and catch the person and all the rest of it. So I don't think the report is saying, and this has to happen now, because obviously the war isn't over, and there is going to be impunity for them whilst they continue to be at war. I mean, it is... Whilst it seems almost silly that when you first hear it, you hear, well, of course they're committing war crimes. We hear about it all the time. But there is, I think, something important about the principle that whenever this ends, there will be at least some comeback on some people. And so whilst nothing is going to happen for the foreseeable future on this, the fact that it might at some point is at least positive.
Samira, we are witnessing things, or we are told things, which really sort of makes the mind boggle in this day and age. Have we seen anything like this in recent history? We haven't, have we?
I'm not sure, really, but it is, the level of brutality is quite shocking, as you say, and it's sort of, I'm sure of of the crimes that are listed, I'm sure that there have been instances in various parts of the world of each of those things happening, but it's all at once, and it's so sudden and so rapid and so sort of all-encompassing that I think that's perhaps one of the most shocking elements, that this has only really come up in the last few months, and it's just suddenly been this huge level of brutality imposed, and it's just brutality across the board. I mean, it doesn't seem like there's any sort of remiss from it. It's not just that these acts of brutality are being carried out. I think one of the particularly horrible details of the report was how sort of the use of humiliation and displaying of mutilated corpses as a deterrent and so on. It's just really nightmarish. And following on from what James was saying, I think there's something valuable in documenting those things. I mean, I think that whether it takes a while to act upon or not, there's a value in a UN body and a sort of international body collecting that evidence in a sort of serious and objective way, rather than, you know, otherwise you don't really know what to believe from a steady drip of quite scandalous stories in the media, very shocking. You don't always know how to unpick what's true or not.
And there's a further benefit to doing this for the ICC, although it's not their report. They've just been called upon to do something. And those who like the ICC as a mechanism for international justice is that many of the African critics of the ICC who say that it only targets Africa, and this has been used quite strongly by President Kenyatta in Kenya to sort of undermine the case against him, critics do say, well, you know, there are awful things going on in the area that the so-called Islamic State called the Islamic State and elsewhere, and nothing is done about those. And this, you know, could bring some additional credibility or some much needed credibility to the ICC as a method of international justice.
Before the break, Samiri, you were talking about the idea of propaganda, the romance of the call to go and join Islamic State. There is this sort of absolute two worlds that never will meet. You have the noble cause, so to speak, of joining Islamic State, and then you have the horrific brutality that seems to be happening. Do you think this latest report from the UN will dampen this fervour?
I mean, I'd like to think it would, but sadly I don't think it realistically will, because so much of that propaganda is based in sort of discounting this type of report as biased, as propaganda in itself from Western governments determined to do down the Islamic State. So I think by the time people are sufficiently immersed in that propaganda to actually make that sort of journey, they're probably at a point where they're not really going to think, OK, hang on, well, the UN said this. I think they'd probably see it as an invalid thing.
Finally, we know which airport code will be looped onto the luggage of Africa's best football players come next January. Check your bags in with a tag marked SSG. And guess what? It'll come off the conveyor at Malabo. That's the capital of Equatorial Guinea. The country has stepped in at the last minute to host next year's Africa Cup of Nations after Morocco, the original hosts, withdrew because of fears of Ebola. James Schneider, I mean, it makes sort of sense that Equatorial Guinea stepped in because it's done it before quite recently. I mean, it's one of Africa's tiniest places and suddenly becomes the capital of football.
Yes, it was two tournaments ago that they co-hosted with Gabon, and it looks like they'll get to qualify, because they were disqualified for a year ago from qualifying for this edition because they
I'm stuck already.
Yeah, because they fielded a supposedly illegitimate player. Because one of the things that Equatorial Guinea does is it basically picks up sort of second rate players who maybe have no real link to Equatorial Guinea and gives them citizenship, and then they get into the team, which is how they did quite well at their own edition of the Cup of Nations. So the body first of all tried to get Egypt to do it. They tried to get them to do it twice. They said no. They asked South Africa. They said no. They asked Ghana. They said no. And all along, Equatorial Guinea saying, yeah, please, we'll do it. We'll do it.
Why are they saying no, these other countries?
Egypt, I think they have concerns about security. South Africa is probably a bit tired of being always the go-to country that has to host it. They had to host the last one in an emergency in the same kind of way. So they had the World Cup in 2010, then they've had an African Cup of Nations since then. They don't want to host it another time. Algeria apparently were quite keen to have it, but that's because they want to get the next one, and this was a way for them to sort of say we're ready for it.
All this, of course, is because Morocco said no because of Ebola. What do you think this means for Morocco, Samira? Have they just shot themselves in the foot politically?
Well, I don't know. They're not the only country to be sort of alarmist about Ebola. I mean, I was reading recently about some of the cases here that there was a delegation of teachers from Gambia, which is 500 miles away from the nearest Ebola country, being their trip being cancelled. They were supposed to come and visit a school in the UK somewhere. So yeah, I think it's sort of, I think, you know, you've sort of got this widespread hysteria, and the fact that there's 54 countries taking part in the Africa Cup and four of them are affected by Ebola, and sort of derailed it.
Well, it's even worse than that, because probably none of the countries that are affected by Ebola will qualify. Yeah. I mean, one of them might qualify, but they probably won't qualify. And Guinea, one of the affected countries, because of Ebola, has been hosting its home games in Morocco.
I'm so lost now. I mean, first, finally, very briefly, James, Samira was talking about the UK being alarmist about, I think it was a group of teachers or whatever you said. Yesterday, our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, wrote a monologue about how one country which has an awful lot of connections to Africa is incredibly good at football and could play an excellent host would be you, the United Kingdom itself. I mean, to what degree do you think it wouldn't be an entirely silly idea for a country outside of Africa, such as the UK or France, to have stepped in and said, look, we've got the infrastructure, we've got the security, we can do it.
And given that most of the players play in Europe, that would work. I understand that Qatar was quite interested in doing it. But again, all of these things... All of these tournaments are political showcases and they're played with politically. Qatar wants it because they don't want the full World Cup to be taken away from them.
We'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. James, have you bought your tickets for Equatorial Guinea yet?
I haven't. I was actually going to go to Morocco, but now I'm not.
That's a whole different ballgame about what happens to people's plane tickets. We'll have to leave it there, though. James Schneider and Samira Shackle, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come then. In the second half of today's Midori House, we'll check in with our man in Milan. He'll be talking about a singing nun, ladies and gentlemen, so sit tight. Then we'll have a little bit of art courtesy of the man who lectured Damien Hirst. We'll find out whether he thought anything of him at the time. And we'll have a little bit of film too, reviewing the great new films that all seem to have come out in one spell this week. But first, before all that, with the latest world news headlines, now here's Bill.
A new United Nations report says Islamic State is committing war crimes and imposing a rule of terror in areas it controls in Syria. The report, compiled after hundreds of witnesses were interviewed, says IS has used extreme violence against civilians. Iraqi officials say their forces have driven out Islamic State fighters from the oil refinery town of Baiji, 200 kilometres north of Baghdad. There are reports of heavy fighting still going on around the refinery, which is Iraq's largest. The Australian city of Brisbane has deployed thousands of police officers as world leaders gather there for the G2 summit. One of the leaders present, President Vladimir Putin from Russia, has condemned US and EU sanctions introduced over Russia's annexation of Crimea. The World Health Organization has begun assessing more than 120 potential treatments for Ebola patients, but so far has found none that definitely work. Despite the apparent success of ZMapp, which was given to two American aid workers who recovered, the WHO says there's no proof it played a role. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life. A benchmark for style.
And you're back with Midori House live here on Monocle 24. The time is 21. 34 in Moscow. It's 18:34 here in London. It's 19:34 in Milan, which is where we can head now to get the latest news from Italy. To help us with that, our correspondent Ivan Carvalho is on the line, ready and raring to go. A very good evening to you, Ivan, just before you head out for your aperitivo in Milan. Bring us the latest news. News from the camp of Giorgio Napolitano, the man who jumped in to save the day last year, wants to go.
Yeah, good evening, Emma. Indeed, Napolitano, I believe, has the right to retirement. He's now 89 years old and reluctantly stayed on last year for a second term of President of the Republic because there was this stalemate, if you recall, the elections early last year, which didn't result in any clear winner. And in the end, the parties end up voting for Napolitano to come back to help guide the country through that period of turmoil before Matteo Renzi became prime minister. And he's now looking at the end of the year. That there are rumors about this. He hasn't denied them, that he wants to end the year going into retirement. So this has set the political chattering classes all in a tizzy about who's going to be the successor.
I mean, you said, obviously, that he's not denied that he's going to retirement. He's been helping in many ways, being a sort of a bolster to Matteo Renzi. But what practical contribution has he actually brought to Italian politics since he was re-elected as president?
Well, he's been able to, as a guiding hand, to ensure that there are reforms in place, that the country is going on the path of putting together these structural reforms, which everybody knows that Italy needs to overhaul its economy. And it's been doing this for several years now. If you recall, when Berlusconi, in 2011, there was the Eurozone crisis, the sovereign debt crisis. There was talk of Italy going into default. And he didn't call elections when Berlusconi resigned. He had already prepared for Mario Monti to come in to bring the country into a reform sort of mandate. And he's been at the side of Matteo Renzi, who is now quite popular. And I believe that Napolitano thinks that now it's a good time because he believes that Matteo Renzi has a solidified political support as the one candidate who can bring the country those reforms.
You say that, you know, obviously he has bolstered support for Renzi. Renzi is not in the crisis that he was, let's say, barely a month or two ago. But nonetheless, Italy without Napolitano, what is that going to look like or feel like?
Well, people say that Matteo Renzi is probably going to look for a very low-profile figure. So names like Romano Prodi, former prime minister, or Walter Veltroni, the former mayor of Rome, will probably not be on that list. And Romano Prodi has already denied that he would be interested in that job. So it goes to a vote of the parliament. It's not voted by the public. And you need a two-thirds majority for the first three rounds of the voting, and then it goes to a simple majority. Renzi may look to have someone who is well-received, but not someone who's a politician who comes from well-known circles. There's talk of possibly Italy having its first female president. We'll have to see. At the moment, it's still early because, again, Napolitano hasn't he hasn't denied the rumors, he doesn't really want to talk about it until the end of the year when Italy finishes its turn as head of the EU presidency.
Okay, we now have Italy back economically at the same levels that it was 14 years ago. Are we looking properly at a long-term recovery for this country now?
It's still going to take a lot of work in terms of the reforms that have to be put in place. Renzi right now is dealing with strikes from the largest union, CGL, and the metal workers. Just today there was another strike. There is calls for the general strike at the beginning of December. And he's having to grapple with these over labor reform, his so-called Jobs Act, which is looking to help the younger generations of workers who don't have these sort of guaranteed benefits in place. When you have an older generation who have sort of stronger rights in terms of for hiring and firing and dismissal, and there's been protests over this Article 18. And he's going to have to grapple with that. He seems to be able to ride out, I think, these strikes because he has some of the other unions who say that it's detrimental and counterproductive to have these strikes now. So I think, you know, his singular popularity, I think, is still able to ride out these strikes.
Okay, let's move on to something of critical importance, which is a singing nun, a lady called Sister Christina. I think a lot of us came across the lady a couple of months ago when she rose to fame in the equivalent of the Voice of Italy. Tell us a little bit more about what the lady has done since then. Or did she win? She won, didn't she?
She won the second season of that contest, and just recently she's debuted an album. Most of them are covers of well-known songs, including Madonna's 1984 classic "Like a Virgin," and that may have, you know, eyebrows raised in various circles, especially in a country like Italy, Catholic Italy. Quite surprisingly, this week, the Vatican has given its, shall we say, blessing in the form of Cardinal Ravesi, who is the president of the Pontifical Council for Culture, saying that it's a good thing to have the singing nun out there with an album. And she actually shot her own video of Like a Virgin in Venice, but obviously the imagery was much more sober. Obviously, she's wearing a nun habit, not the racy wedding gown that Madonna had. And there's talk even of her going to San Remo next year, the famous annual film, music festival in Italy, to promote again. And I think the Vatican is quite happy about this.
Well, I mean, we can't see this amazing lady. Let's have a listen, though, to her.
Like a virgin.
Okay, Ivan, how many copies of that have you downloaded since it first came out?
Well, it's quite interesting when you think about this phenomenon. Would this have been the case? Would the Vatican have come out and proved this sort of thing if it was still Pope Reitzinger, Pope Benedict XVI, sitting there in Rome? But I think it's curious that she's really hit struck a chord, as it were, and she'll be at a Christmas concert with Patti Smith singing for Pope Francis in December. And so for right now, it's one of those feel-good stories that has a lot of people going to the shops or downloading. So at least on the music front, Italy, at least this week, is on the front pages.
Pope Francis, Patti Smith and a singing nun. I think I have just entered a dream. Ivan Cavaglio there. Thank you very much indeed for bringing us the latest from Milan. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we talk to the man who taught the likes of Damien Hirst, and we find out whether he thought he was any good or not.
On the menu, we explore the delicious, diverse and eminently digestible world of food, drink and hospitality every week. Join me, Marcus Hippi, as I meet everyone from the bakers to the makers who are redefining the culinary landscape.
Many people think that it might be gamey somehow because these are hairy animals that have horns, but it's quite the opposite. I think the milk has a cleaner, sweeter flavor than cow milk.
We'll also head to Kenji's kitchen for a roundup of restaurant reviews, interviews with top chefs and trade secrets with our Asia editor at large, Kenji Hall, in Tokyo and beyond.
The beer market has been changing rapidly for some time now. It seems like almost every month a new pub that specializes in craft beer is opening.
All that and even a dinner party soundtrack recommendation, so your ears are catered for as well as your belly. A healthy serving of the finest free-range fare to sate your radio appetite each week. That's the menu on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. This is Emma Nelson. Now, for those who weren't students at Jacob Cramer College in Leeds in the 1980s, you could be forgiven for not being entirely across the lectures of Glyn Thompson. Glyn Thompson taught the compulsory history of art module on the Art Foundation course. Among those in the rows in about 1983 to 1984 was one young Damien Hirst. Now an exhibition is beginning of the works, the back lectures of Glyn Thompson, and Glyn joins me on the line now. A very warm welcome to the programme. Just before we get to talk about who was in your audience and what they were being taught, what was it like looking back at your lecture notes? Did you suddenly realise that you were teaching stuff that you perhaps have forgotten about?
Absolutely. It's extraordinary how much it's possible to have forgotten what one was doing. You know, I mean, I've done a lot of things in between, and I ended up teaching art history at the University of Leeds in an entirely different way, a kind of classical art history. So when I read the lecture notes, I thought, goodness me, was I talking about all this sort of stuff? And I had really literally forgotten most of it. And it's very much a part of the time. I mean, there's reference to Buckminster Fuller and Victor Papanek and Raymond Lurley. I mean, it actually tells me now what we were all thinking about, which I think everybody doing what I was doing right across the country were actually articulating the same sorts of ideas. And it was a period when it was fashionable to have the art historian on the studio floor, because it was a consequence of the Summerson Colchin report, which is about the gentrification of design education. So students had to do history or theory or general studies or whatever you want to call it. So they needed people. I mean, I did fine art and art history as a first degree at Nottingham, so I'd always walk that kind of line that divided the two, which for me was, you know, a line you crossed very easily. So instead of having kind of art historians who did academic teaching of, you know, the history of English painting from 1500 to some other period, you had people like me who taught really the history of ideas, using examples from every time and place that seemed to be evidence of human creativity. So it's a much broader kind of curriculum that we introduced in that period. So it was more anthropology, ethnography, and archaeology than it was formal art history. And of course, we were also teaching students who were going to do design courses, because the foundation course prepared people to apply to any design discipline. So you couldn't teach the kind of art history you would teach in a university. It had to be about that human enterprise that is engaged with visual communication in all forms.
Of course, your module was compulsory. How well attended were your lectures? Was there a good appetite for them?
Well, there was. I mean, of course, it tailed off towards the end of the summer term when people were obsessed with going off on interviews and so on. But I would say for the first 25 weeks of the year, it was pretty much like an 80-90% attendance all the time. It was an hour a week, and it was very much integrated into the main program. The students were supposed to take ideas out of the art history lectures and apply them in their own work. So it was very much breaking down this difference between, if you like, theoretical and practical knowledge. Yeah, it was doing the praxis rather than the separate practices, so to speak.
In the beginning of this interview, I mentioned that among the rows watching these compulsory lectures was one Damien Hirst. Did you meet him? Do you have any recollection of him?
Well, yeah, I mean, one had a general recollection of kind of everybody, and everybody was noticeable for some reason, because I was working in the studios as well. If I'd just been parachuted in once a week and given a lecture and parachuted out again, I would never have spoken to a soul. It's 1 hour a week of quite intensive, you know, a kind of tsunami of information and imagery. But because one met them again on the studio floor, and one met them as a tutor of a tutorial group, and one met them as a tutor of a particular kind of activity across the year, and in specific activities, you kind of got to know them. I actually got to know Guy Harvey, for example, who was Marcus Harvey's brother, who came after Damien, because I knew him very well, because he was in my tutorial group. So you would know different students in different ways, and you'd know about them. You'd hear staff talking about these students that they were dealing with that you weren't necessarily dealing directly. So I would have talked to him quite a lot in general kind of studio activities, but I can't remember a single word that I said to him in that kind of context.
So there wasn't any great indication at the time that this was a man who was going to turn into one of the great YBA artists?
If anybody tells you that we realised he was going to do that, they're talking through their back teeth. I mean, he wasn't, in a sense, remarkable. He'd applied to he came to the college, applied from Allerton Grange School, where he was doing A-level, and he failed to get in the first time. And his teachers rang up and said, go on, give him the chance, he's really keen. We know he's, you know, maybe he's not the greatest draftsman since Rembrandt, but he's dead keen. So we said, okay, send him away, tell him to go and do some drawings and come back. And the test was really, would he do the drawings and come back, not what was the quality of the drawing, so to speak. And he came back and got in. But then, of course, he didn't progress. At the end of the year, he failed to progress onto higher education. He applied to Cardiff and St. Martin's, I think, and failed to get in. And students like that tended to drift away. So he would have been the ones who were very disappointed, really, at the end of going through the process of finding you haven't gotten your first or second choice courses. Because, to be honest, after the second choice courses, there aren't many great courses left, so to speak. So he went to London. He disappeared and went to London. And, I mean, in a way, nobody remembered him in that sense. It was astonishing when this extraordinary creature re-emerged, you know, like 6 or 7 years later.
Well, you say it's an extraordinary creature who emerged from a rather unremarkable individual. Do you think he's remarkable now?
Well, he's remarkable for a certain kind of thing, isn't he? Which is this extraordinary success he's had, you know, for being a certain kind of animal. But whether or not that, I mean, there's always a real danger of assuming that quality in art is related to success in art. You know, the business isn't like that. The reasons why art might be good or bad is nothing to do with the reasons, completely separate from how commodities get marketed and consumed in the way that they do. So that idea that, you know, the art, good art succeeds, is nonsense. It doesn't. I mean, it has to succeed for all sorts of reasons that have nothing to do with whether you're a good artist or not.
Glyn Thompson, I'm afraid we'll have to end it there. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. It's 18:50 here in London, 10:50 a.m. in Los Angeles, which is where we head in a moment. But just to let you know, Educating Damien, which is, of course, Glyn Thompson's exhibition, is on from today, the 14th of November, to the 9th of January at the Tetley Gallery. And it looks rather good. I was told, in no uncertain terms, that if you know Damien Hirst's art, you just go to that exhibition and it's kind of all there. Anyway, right, let's talk about cinema. And I mentioned that it's just gone 10 to 11 in the morning in Los Angeles, which is where we can join Karen Krasanovich, our regular lady of cinema. Welcome to the programme, Karen.
Lovely to hear your dulcet tones.
Let's talk about The Foxcatcher.
Yeah, we can do that. Well, it's, you know, it's really interesting to come here. Now, Foxcatcher just opened, or is opening today in the States. And it's interesting to come to the States and get a different, you get a real different feel for films that are opening and also for upcoming Oscar talk. Now, Foxcatcher is based on a true story. It's directed by Bennett Miller, who did Moneyball and Capote. Capote's one of my favorites of all. And it stars Steve Carell. We generally think of him as a comic actor, Channing Tatum and Mark Ruffalo, as the story of an Olympic wrestling champ and his brother who are come under the spell, I suppose, of a millionaire, John DuPont, who's the heir to the DuPont legacy. It's a true story. It's moved around a little bit in time. It's not a comfortable film to watch, but the performances and the unfolding of the tale are just amazing, and you won't notice that Steve Carell looks very, very different because he's wearing a different nose, actually.
And in fact, Bennett Miller got the Best Director at Cannes earlier on this year. I mean, what marks it out as such a good film?
The way it's laid out, I think the script is astonishing. I think that the pace is amazing because it's very subtle. I mean, this is a film for grown-ups. You know, there aren't any explosions that I can remember anyway. Might be one. But it's a serious adult film about personality and identity. And I know that sounds a bit dry, but I've never seen a film like this. And they do think that Carol is probably going to be up for the Oscar. That's what they're saying here. Anyway, for Best Supporting Actor, where Channing Tatum may be outside for a lead actor.
Let's move on to another biopic that is getting an enormous amount of attention. It is, of course, The Imitation Game, the story of, it's Benedict Cumberbatch and Keira Knightley explaining to us in the 21st century how the Enigma Code was cracked. Or is it much, much more than that?
It is. I mean, you know, it's really easy with a film like this to be glib because it's such a good film. It doesn't really matter what you say about it because it's superb. You could say, yeah, it's Keira and Benedict explaining the Enigma Code to dumb people, but it's not really. It's a beautifully shot film, absolutely stunningly done. Think sort of The King's Speech only with computers in World War II. That's kind of really what it is. It's directed by Morten Tildum, who did The Headhunters, a wonderful Scandinavian director. And it's based on a very, very good book it's called The Enigma by Andrew Hodges. And this is basically the story of Alan Turing. And Benedict Cumberbatch really put his shoulder into this, getting this film together. It was on the blacklist for, I think, 2 years, leading the blacklist. Those are scripts that are going unproduced that are considered of extremely high quality. And he's actually said that he thinks that Alan Turing should be on the British banknotes. And basically, Turing was a genius, a mathematical genius, also ultra-marathon runner, who is persecuted for his homosexuality. Now, this is handled very subtly here, but not with kid gloves. So it's an acceptable film, and the great thing about this, it's an important, potent subject, but it's presented in a way that it can be shown all around the world, which is important.
What kind of film, what is the story within it? Because you hear of Turing's homosexuality, which ultimately led to him taking his own life when he was just 41. Then you obviously have him cracking the Enigma code before all that. But you also have the portrait of the man who was renowned to be very difficult to deal with because of whatever condition he had that made him brilliant in some areas, but incapable of making warm human contact.
Well, yeah, I mean, it, even though we were not supposed to use the word anymore, he does come across presented as if he's had AIDS, got Asperger's, not autism. He can socialize, but he's not really that interested. And so Keira Knightley's character, I think her name is, I should have her name right on the tip of my tongue, and I don't. She steps in to sort of make him look normal in a way, because it's more acceptable. But also, she's a friend of his, and he doesn't have a lot of friends. He's not really that interested in friends. What really excites him is solving puzzles. And as we go on, and I don't want to reveal too much about this, because I want people to see it, but he goes on, and he is persecuted because he's revealed as a homosexual, which, of course, was against the law at the time. And he goes on to take chemicals which chemically castrate him, which I think is quite... I mean, there's a very, very telling scene toward the end of the film. And it's heartbreaking. It's really heartbreaking. This is a man who was as much of a World War II hero as anyone else, just because he was difficult to get along with and didn't socialize. We have a tendency to sort of think of him as being mentally unstable. I don't believe he was. Not presented, anyway.
Let's have a little listen to it.
This war... We're not winning it. If you speak a word of what I'm about to show you, you will be executed for high treason.
It's beautiful. It's the greatest encryption device in history, and the Germans use it for all communications.
Everyone thinks Enigma is unbreakable.
Let me try, and we'll know for sure.
Mr. Turing, do you know how many died because of it?
I don't.
Three. While we've been having this conversation.
The Imitation Game, a film which, as you say, Karen Krasanovich, it sounds a little bit like The King's Speech insofar as it is. It sounds terribly, terribly British. We have a little bit of time to talk about one more film, The Drop. James Gandolfini in his final role, which is a terribly sad thing to say, but was this the film that he'd been waiting to make?
I don't, to be honest, no. I mean, he's wonderful in it, and he was wonderful in his previous film, Enough Said, as well. But this is really Tom Hardy's movie. I mean, James is supporting Tom Hardy and a puppy, but it's a twisty, turny crime drama based on Dennis Lehane's short story Animal Rescue, and it's directed beautifully by Belgian director and writer Michael R. Roskam. It's really a terrific film to watch. It's quite noirish, but quite fun and quite light, and it's wonderful to see Gandolfini again. But it is. It's not a breakthrough role for him, but it's just wonderful to have him on film, really. It's a good film.
Very briefly, if you have but one evening to spare, is it going to be The Imitation Game or The Drop?
Imitation Game, I think, is a must-see. Yep.
Thank you very much indeed, Karen Krasanovich, for joining us on the line from Los Angeles. That's all we have time for today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, James Schneider, who's the editorial director at New African Magazine, and the London-based journalist Samira Shackle. My thanks to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, and our researchers, David Pleasant and Alia Massoud, and our studio manager, Chad Chilvers, too. Next up after the headlines, Marcus Hippie brings us our weekly food and drink portion, courtesy of The Menu. Then at 2200 hours is The Monocle Daily. I'll be back behind the microphone, joined by Peter Cardwell. Hope you can join us for that. This show will be back at the same time on Monday at 1800 hours London time. But for now, from this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thank you for listening and have a great weekend.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.